The Sandstone Foundation presents the social, legal, and economic costs of religious paternalism and female dependency, recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel, Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
We brought networks for you, and I hope you'll pick one up and give us a read. I have with me also Justice Christine Durham, and she is one of the Supreme Court justices in the state of Utah. She is the first and only woman to hold that title. I hope she will not be the last, and I hope she will not be alone for long. And I have also Jenna, her real true name is Virginia, but we call her Jenna Kelson. She is the director of the Phoenix Institute, which is, again, the oldest organization for advocacy of women in Utah, and she is also a founder of Network Magazine. We realize that we have a very heavy title, and I hope that you read it with the same sense of irony that we wrote it with. Peggy Fletcher and I kind of did that together, and we had a little laugh over it when we did it. And it's both serious and ironic. Not really meant to be as heavy as it sounds. But the subject for today's presentation really grew from a personal experience that I had. I was asked last February to make a response at the University of Utah to the bishop's pastoral on the U.S. economy. You may remember that the Catholic bishop spent about 4 years analyzing the U.S. economy and making a very, very, very long series of recommendations about what was sort of going rotten in the state of the state, as far as people are concerned in the United States, and making another series of recommendations about what could be done about it. And so they sent me the pastoral, and I read it. And this is my response to that. And I'll talk more about how I felt when I made it later. But the format for our time together today will be that I'm going to read it to you. I'm going to pretend that you're the bishop sitting out there and the ministers and all the political people that were there that day. I'm going to read it to you, and then I'm going to ask Jenna Kelson to respond to it from an economic point of view. And I'm going to ask Justice Durham to respond to it from a legal point of view. What I read will only be a few minutes because we were only given a few minutes to make our responses. So it's very capsulized. And what they will do is enlarge on it. And then after they're through, I will respond to my own writing from a social point of view. All right? First, let me thank Bishop Wiegland for inviting me here to respond to the first draft of the Bishop's Pastoral on the U.S. economy. I consider the action of the bishops a creative and courageous effort to face a problem which seriously affects and threatens the American dream. Indeed, I believe with the bishops that the issue of poverty is crucial to the future of the democracy in America and in the world. Accepting the goal that the bishops state, that the function of an economy is to operate in such a way that it respects human dignity, I maintain that we are at a crossroads in time, faced with the most basic revolutionary change which has ever confronted persons and their religions. Women, since the beginning of time, have been protected by men, and they now find themselves on their own. The cliché has been that what is good for the goose is also good for the gander. This is another way of saying that human dignity, all these thousands of years, has always meant male dignity. Most often it has meant white male dignity. Women and persons of color have been invisibly included in that equation. Now, women are simply left out. Until now, husbands have provided a living for their wives and children. Moral values that reinforce this traditional system of economic caring were conveyed from parents to children. Wives were able to survive under the protection of their husbands. They do not expect and did not expect and have not learned how to provide for themselves. But the world has changed. Since the early 50s, the divorce rate has grown. Until now, 2 in 3 marriages end in divorce. For a woman in the United States and in the world, the greatest single predictor of her economic health is her marital status. When a man is divorced, his income increases 42%. When a woman is divorced, her income decreases 73%. This woman usually has children. Her ex-husband usually does not, in fewer than 33% of the cases, pay child support. Typically, she is a young woman with no job skills who never expected to become the head of a family. According to the 1983 U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, half of all families living in poverty are now headed by women. In Utah, the state of families, 96% of all those who receive aid to families with dependent children are single heads of households who are women and their children. Women are not surviving in 1985, and women of color are not surviving even less, and children of both are growing up in families that are suffering a value vacuum forced on them by circumstances. Traditional society, including every church organization that can be named, participates in a deception that is crippling women and changing the life view of their children in ways that we cannot predict. Historically, when the dignity of man was intact, the dignity of women and children was assured through them. That mechanism no longer works. Unfortunately, women still believe in it. Unfortunately, they are still told at home, in school, and in church that they will marry and be protected. Unfortunately, they often learn the truth only after they have children and are left to fend for themselves and find themselves in a job market that pays half a salary. Educational systems, health organizations, employers, religions, all must change their message to women, or women will continue to live in a prolonged state of betrayal. In 1985 and in the foreseeable future, a woman must count on providing for her own economic survival. She must know that if she has children, she is going to have to provide for them herself. Very likely, she must come to expect to work 28 years, which is the average length of time 9 in 10 women now work full-time. If she is to be denied information about how pregnancies occur, if she is to be not denied birth control information and birth control devices, if she is to be prevented from having abortion when she is unwittingly pregnant, then she must be told from the beginning that economic dependency is as debilitating as heroin addiction, that getting pregnant without the means to support a child is as crippling as polio once was, and that depending on Prince Charming is as unreliable as betting on the horses. Women do not need to be taken care of, except temporarily. Those who are now paralyzed between their expectations and reality need time to recover. There must be a period of transition while the rewards of independence are learned. But the young women of the world, those who will either spring free or make up tomorrow's welfare rolls, simply need to be told the truth as often and in as many ways as possible. They do not need to be taken care of. They need to hear the truth. They need to hear it especially from their fathers, from their mothers, their schools, and above all, their churches. Such statements are absent from this list of institutional factors contributing to poverty in the Bishop's Pastoral. I encourage you to include them. Thank you. That was my statement, and we are here to respond to that. I might say as a kind of slight sociological introduction to this, and the women in the room will understand it, and the men in the room will have a hard time imagining. Women are fathered, which is what paternalism means, constantly, from the moment of their birth, by everyone. They are fathered by their fathers, they are fathered by their brothers, they are fathered by their organizations, they are fathered in the schools, their churches behave as fathers, their government behaves as a father. We know how to be daughters. And we learn it almost exclusively of all other skills. And daughters are protected and taken care of. Or at least they were protected and taken care of. Now we're living in a different world, and we find ourselves without many of the fathers we've all come to depend on, and there are severe and crippling consequences to that, which is what we are here to talk about today, and I'll have Jenna Kelson speak first.
Karen forgot one piece of the format, and that is that we want to spend time answering your questions. I actually work a lot better that way. I don't do well giving speeches, and so I'm very anxious to, after we have given a few remarks, to get a hold of this mic and shove it in your faces and get you to ask us questions and respond to the ideas that we've put out. And so my remarks are brief, although I am like any other person at this table. You push my buttons and I can go forever. I want to respond more from what I see every day at the Institute. Phoenix Institute has women pouring in at a rate that we cannot handle. We do not have the resources to handle. We do not have either the staff or the money to get more staff to work with those women. These women are all in transition, in various forms of transition, all seeking economic self-sufficiency, which is a new idea to many of them, most of them. They want it, but they don't know how to get it. They don't know what's wrong with them. They think they're crazy. They think they're inept. They feel that they have no skills. They're without resources. Their families and friends have given up on them. Their church and their state have given up on them. And they come to us destitute. I was in a group this morning with women that was one of every kind. It was unusual. We don't always get that. But the age range was from 16 to 52. From a woman with a child, 17 months, to a woman who had 12 children, all single, either through divorce. No, there was one woman that was still married, excuse me. But most of them were divorced or widowed. One woman, husband, had been without work for 4 years. They have lived through every asset they had, and she was now seeking work. Her husband's still alive. They're still married. And she's trying to find work after 12 years out of the labor force. And 4 children, by the way. There was a woman there whose husband was very successful. She was what she termed herself to be a corporate displaced homemaker. Her husband had divorced her. She also had 4 children. And he had divorced her after 20 years of marriage. And had married his secretary. She was now trying to find work. She'd also lived through every one of her resources, was on welfare. We had young women in that room, the 16-year-old that I mentioned, who was never been married, had a 17-month-old child. A Hispanic woman with 4 children, ranging from 8 to 5 months. Every kind of desperate situation that I think you could mention to me was in that room. The reason that I was in there, I don't often get in there. I'm always sorry that I'm not with them more often, because it keeps me in touch with their pain and helps me in my advocacy role and my seeking of funds to work with them. But I was in there because we are at this point in time trying to, in a state, get a bill passed at the legislature that would fund displaced homemaker programs. And I had been up there and yesterday, and in a brutal committee meeting, been torn apart by the legislature, who is not prone to fund such a program. And we were having come to see the group and what we're doing, some legislative analysts, and I took them in and I sat them down. I said, here, you talk with these women. And it was very strong and powerful experience. But every one of those women is, as Karen has said, has gone through her life believing that she would be taken care of. The woman who was 52 with 12 children had been divorced for several years. Yeah. And she's been living with her children and had been moving from one child to another. The whole time that she'd been living with each of those children, the ones that would provide her with a home, she had been doing volunteer work, going to work on a regular basis, giving her time to hospitals and to libraries and to various institutions, hoping in vain that one of them would see how wonderful she was and give her a job. And it had dawned on her, finally, that wasn't going to happen. As long as she volunteered, they would accept that volunteer work. But that wasn't getting her a job. Now, she's 52, and our public programs allow us to give us funds to work with women and men who are seeking work, who are older than 55 or older. So she doesn't qualify for our program. So what do? We have to raise money, and that's how we help her. Well, I would invite any of you to come over and see what's happening at the Institute. It's Utah's version of the feminization of poverty. We have our own version, and our version is like the national feminization of poverty. The economic situation is stark, and statistics tell us that unless our communities do something about the growing problem economically of women who are in such situations as I have described, that our poverty rolls by the year 2000 will be solely made up of women and children. We will be creating a new class of children raised in poverty, solely in poverty. Right now, one quarter of our children live in poverty in the state of Utah. The reality is that women no longer have the luxury to be at home and be housewives and mothers for very long periods of time. The reality is that the average woman now works 35 years of her life. The feminization of poverty is caused by three things. It's caused because of the idea in women's heads and men's heads that they should be dependent and they should be taken care of. It is caused by the fact that although we have an equal pay for equal work law, it is not enforced. It is not in actuality being a reality. It is caused because women's work is unilaterally paid less than men's work, so that a woman who works is likely to work at a wage that is close to poverty. The average wage in Utah, I think, is around $13,000 a year. 80% of the women in Utah earn less than $16,000, regardless of how many children they have, regardless of whether they have a husband or not. That is what the average wage is. And it is caused because of that discrepancy around that we are now calling comparable work. And that is that those women's jobs pay less than men's jobs unilaterally across the board. I'd like to switch just a little bit to what we found out when we work with women and get them moving into a job or a career. Make a big distinction between a job and a career. When they move into a career and get on an upward path of mobility, they find out three very important things. One, that an independence in marriage creates a strong relationship. They're married, that if they're independent and can balance that relationship, that it creates a strong marriage, and that dependence creates a weak marriage. They find out that when they have permission to have choices, when they give themselves permission to have choices, rather than no choices, which is pretty much the way it is right now, that that creates themselves to be a strong individual. And they find out that when they learn how to deliver clear, direct messages to the people that are important around them, both on the job and in their family, that that creates self-responsibility. And that, in turn, causes their self-esteem to be incredibly high. Look forward to your questions.
Christine Durham. I've had some difficulty in locating some coherence from my remarks today. Part of the problem is, I think, one of the chicken and the egg. As I've struggled with the title, now I know how it came to be. I would have struggled less if I'd known earlier. I had a very difficult time trying to decide whether female dependency, as it may or may not be related to the doctrinal constructs and religious teachings of churches, is caused by or is a cause of some of the legal effects that I want to talk about. I was unable to solve those problems, and so what I'm going to offer you today is what I hope will be a thoughtful stream of consciousness from which you can pick and choose for those ideas which may stimulate your own thinking. One of the things that occurred to me is that I think it goes without saying, and we might not have bothered to come today if all we came for is to establish the notion that paternalism as a religious doctrine, a governmental device, an economic policy, or in any form fosters dependency. In turn, I think we could agree that dependency as a condition cripples the growth of a sense of responsibility for oneself. Furthermore, I will assert that restrictions on the capacity for exercising responsibility characterize the history of women before the law. Now, to digress on that theme for a moment, and I'll come back to it shortly, I'd also like to comment that the church as an institution has been and remains, to a large extent, a dominant force in society, and I mean worldwide society. I talk not just of Western society. It has historically shaped other institutions, such as the law, government, and education. It has been and remains a primary source of personal, moral, family, and social values. Now, as I hope I indicated by my reference to Eastern as well as Western civilizations, by the church I do not refer to the dominant religion in this particular part of the world, to the Catholic Church, to the early Christian Church, or to any other form of organized religion. I would like to illustrate that, if you don't mind, with an anecdote I heard just the other evening from a young friend of mine who's attending my alma mater in Massachusetts, Wellesley College. She was describing the development of feminism and some of the issues that have been of significance on the college campus in recent years. And she talked about the fact that Hillel, the organization of Jewish women on campus, had been extremely active and quite militant in the recent year, claiming that there was anti-Semitism and religious discrimination in that form on the college campus. I was appalled. That bore no resemblance to anything I remembered from my days there, and I asked her to tell me about it. Turned out that one of the issues that was of great concern to the members of Hillel on the campus of Wellesley College, which is a women's college, was the selection and presence on the campus of a female rabbi. Most of the members of Hillel are Orthodox Jews, and the selection of a female rabbi ran counter to their religious principles.
I use that as an illustration from another than my own, because some of the examples I might have picked from my own might have been more embarrassing to me. But I want to emphasize that when I talk about the church, I am talking about organized religion in the form of a collection of doctrinal precepts, the development of ritual, and the mandatory adherence of significant numbers of people to those principles and rituals. My premise is that the doctrinal orientation and cultural attitudes of religious institutions generally toward women have had and continue to have direct legal and economic consequences, or at least to be directly related to legal and economic factors for women. There are a set of stereotypical assumptions, free-floating, if you will, but very prevalent in religious teaching, about the nature of woman with a capital W and man with a capital M. Any attempts which we make to explore the true nature of woman, again with a capital letter, will be hindered by the influence of those stereotypes that contribute to that construct. There's something else that's interesting about this prevailing construct of women that is so much a part of organized religion. It is, like the social constructs that exist in other social institutions, largely a male product, because men have controlled the church in the same fashion that they have controlled societal institutions, other societal institutions throughout history, and they have consequently had the power to shape them and to define the roles of men and women within them. For an example, I'll draw upon the institution of the law in the form of the United States Supreme Court. In 1981, that court upheld the constitutionality of male-only selective service draft registration, even though since the mid-1970s, the court had been requiring a very high threshold of justification for any governmental discrimination based on sex. In this case, however, the draft registration case, the court upheld the draft distinctions for the reason that women were excluded by law from serving in combat in the military service, and by service regulations as well as by statute. And since the purpose of the draft registration legislation, according to the court, was to assist the training of combat troops, women and men were not similarly situated, in the language of the court, vis-a-vis the draft. So you get the picture. The court says men and women are different. Well, why are they different for purposes of draft registration? Well, they're different because Congress has passed a law and the military has regulations that says women can't serve in combat. So they're different, and it's okay for Congress to likewise discriminate between them, distinguish between them for purposes of registration. The male-only registration requirement was therefore upheld. Now, clearly, this dissimilarity found by the court was not biological, but rather social and legal. It was a distinction based upon a law enacted by Congress. It was a governmentally created difference. The court's opinion in this case illustrated two things. First of all, that sex role stereotyping still plays a significant role in judicial thinking, and judges tend to reflect a great portion of the law as we understand it in this country. Second, it is always possible, if one is looking for it, to find some difference between men and women if one is seeking for a way to justify discrimination. In earlier eras, our view of women, or the law's view of women, was certainly more restrictive, but similar principles were operative. And as I share this information with you, I'd like you to think about the sources of some of these principles. Over a century ago, the same court, different membership, of course, rejected Myra Bradwell's claim that the state of Illinois could not constitutionally bar her and all other women in the state from practicing law. It was quite clear that something had gone awry in the makeup of Myra Bradwell. It's unlikely that Justice Bradley even saw the inconsistency and incongruity of what he wrote in his opinion with the facts of Myra Bradwell's life. And is everyone here or maybe I would have to say, is every male here, since of course no female would have been in this position, is every male here sure that if he had been alive in 1873, he would have acted differently? To live in a society is to be conditioned by it, and we are all products of our society in terms of all of its institutions, including its religious ones. Let me leave that example and talk for just a minute about this construct and where it comes from. And I'm sharing some ideas with you that I uncovered in some research I did for a talk at the University of Utah last spring. The social definition of woman, this woman with a capital W that I mentioned, has been constructed around the needs of men premise. Not just a desire for support and responsibility in the domestic sphere of life, but rather, according to one commentator, a primary need to overcome deep-seated doubts about individual worth and perhaps even about identity. Not just the stereotype, but women's subordination, too, has important roots in the process by which men identify themselves through determining what women are. Margaret Mead and numerous sociologists and psychologists since her sum it up this way. The little boy learns that he must act like a boy, do things to prove that he is a boy, and prove it over and over again, while the little girl learns that she is a girl, and all she has to do to continue to be a girl is to refrain from acting like a boy. Being masculine is something a boy has to achieve through attaining status and power in the individualistic, competitive, and hierarchical society of other boys. This process of identity formation would seem to have a strong influence on the development of a sense of self as a separate and independent existing being, as opposed to a sense of self more typical of girls that is inclusive of others and of relationships. Therefore, the theory is that if man sees woman chiefly as other, namely different from himself, foreign to himself, and therefore as potentially dangerous or threatening, it is because his own sense of self may be at stake. That is, he defines femininity by way of establishing what he must not be: delicate, timid, domesticated, passive, dependent. And he may feel a need for the construct of woman as all of those things in order to understand what he, man, is. Now, these gender constructs are categories of supreme importance, and they have had considerable impact on our legal system and on legal systems throughout the world. The word woman, unlike the word man, is often used as an epithet, and the reason is that the construct of women, of woman, is filled with the content of our traditional view of femininity. The result is what Dorothy Denniston calls the under-personification of women, which ties in very clearly to this notion of dependency. Like the black, who is an invisible man with his individual character and personality hidden behind his color, a woman's qualities as an individual, a person, are obscured by the abstraction woman. Think about that passage from Bradwell versus Illinois. Justice Bradley was not writing about Myra Bradwell. Nothing he said about women in that opinion bore any resemblance to the woman or her life or accomplishments. She was under-personified, she disappeared, she became invisible. Now, one real difference between men and women is biological and their roles in sexual and reproductive functioning. That's one of the reasons why this experience that man may have of woman as a construct who is different or other than he results in objectification. And it results also in the objectification of her sexuality. Now, you may think I'm a long way from the law, but let me take you back for a moment and refer to you to an opinion decided in 1977 by the United States Supreme Court, in which it upheld an Alabama state prison regulation that forbade hiring women as guards in maximum security prisons for men when the position would require close proximity to prisoners. The Supreme Court agreed that federal law prohibited the use of sex stereotypes in setting employment standards. That was a given. but said that a woman applicant's ability to maintain order in the prison could be directly reduced by her womanhood. The inmates, deprived of a normal heterosexual environment, might assault a woman guard because she was a woman. Of course, in any prison, there's a legitimate concern for the safety of guards. It may also be true that women guards in a men's prison are at risk in ways that male guards are not. But prison experts testified at the trial in the lower court that women guards could be used safely and effectively in such an environment. And the record also contained evidence of the success in that jurisdiction, it was California, with women guards in men's prisons. That experience was lost. It became invisible and disappeared for a majority of the justices of the Supreme Court who were unable to see beyond the abstraction of woman as a potential victim of sexual exploitation. The court thus reinforced the stereotypic view of women as vulnerable sex objects by using that view as a justification for a result in that particular case. Now, a central feature of the classical definition of femininity is unquestionably the quality of being pleasing to men. But femininity of the traditional kind means more than that. It means submissiveness, dependence, and domesticity. These features of the construct of woman reinforce a system of control by men over the sexuality and maternity of women. In American society, this control has been achieved through a variety of institutional means, both governmental and private. Prominent among the means historically used has been the law. The range of controls can be called to mind just by reciting a list of legal topics you'd find in any law review index. Marriage, marital property, divorce, control over and responsibility for children, illegitimacy, abortion, contraception, prostitution, and rape. Women have traditionally been kept at home or submissive or both by such private sanctions as ostracism of the fallen woman, that is, women who were sexually aggressive or who had left male protection. Discrimination in employment, including sexual harassment on the job, and virtual exclusion from some professions. Now, to look at a more recent example, and I'll try to be brief because I'm overstaying my time, I was very interested about 6 months ago to come across an article in the Journal of the Legal Profession which postulated a very interesting thesis. The name of the article is Gender Discrimination in Employment of Attorneys, Feminists Sharpen the Issues. The author of the article did a survey of the literature and took a look at recent findings and publications involving the plight of women in the legal profession and the economic disparities that exist between their earnings and status and those of men. The pattern is very similar, even within that fairly rarefied group, to the one that Jenna described generally. The thesis of the article was that a considerable part of the disparity between men and women in employment status and earnings derives not from sex discrimination, but from the disadvantages that marriage imposes on women. And it proceeded to document from a number of studies, largely associated with educated and higher income individuals, but nevertheless, well, there are some of the studies weren't so narrow in their sampling. But what those studies suggest that it is that the averages that Jenna described to you, when broken out into the conditions of the people involved, seem to fall most heavily on married women when compared to either single men or married men. So that single women do not experience the gap in as great percentages as do married women. Now, the conclusion of this particular article was that more research needs to be done, and we need to learn to understand this research better because it has some very significant implications for the way we go about trying to narrow that gap at all. But this article explored the possibility that three factors have an impact on the gap. And I don't want to spend too much time in them because they're kind of jargony and so on, but one is hypergamy, the tendency of women to marry up in status, thereby subjecting any career aspirations they have to unfavorable comparison with those of their husbands. Homogamy, where like marries like, and again they were looking at lawyers, so you had female lawyers and male lawyers. The female lawyers were disadvantaged vis-a-vis their male counterparts because they tended in practice to defer professional goals to personal ones, whereas their husbands did not. And then the third, which is related, is the sexual division of labor in households. This notion of hypergamy and homogamy is interesting. In 79, Virginia Slims did a survey of approximately 1,500 respondents focusing on spouse employee mobility. And when they asked the question, suppose both a husband and wife work at good and interesting jobs, and the husband is offered a very good job in another city, assuming they have no children, makes it a lot easier, which one of these solutions do you think they should seriously consider? Fully 76%, three-quarters of the men questioned, chose the wife should quit her job, relocate with her husband, and try to get another job in the new place. Substantially more women than that, 85%, agreed. Only 20% of men chose the option that the husband should turn down the job and stay where he is so that the wife can continue with her job, and even fewer women than that, only 11%, agreed. That's what hypergamy and division of labor in the household and so on mean in economic terms, and its impact on economic discrimination may be more than we can understand at the present time. Now, the reason this was interesting to me is that marriage is a legal institution. It is also a social, and it is also a religious institution. And our values and assumptions and our traditional structuring of marriage come directly from our religious upbringing and background. In a recent work on the marriage contract, one scholar describes the three following characteristics of the traditional, and you'll see the religious content, notion of marriage, of the marriage contract. First is that the husband is head of the household. Second is that the husband is responsible for support of the wife and any children. And third, that the wife is responsible for domestic services and child care. Those are the three traditional characteristics of the legal contract of marriage. Now, those characteristics are no longer legally enforceable. Well, they never have been. Try enforcing support in an ongoing marriage. That right only becomes enforceable after the marriage is ended. But it is those values, true, absolutely true, those values come to us from other sources. Think about the churches you have known, and you will recognize one major source of those particular values. As the examples I've used show, many traditional and historic religious assumptions no longer describe, nor are they even particularly useful in understanding the real world. Changes and growth in all of our social institutions are inevitable. As the law has changed, so will it change more, and we need to look for new definitions and for new ways to accept responsibility for ourselves, to teach our daughters to accept responsibility for themselves, and to foster the growing acceptance of responsibility on behalf of women who have never been taught to do that. Before I close, let me just share with you the observations of one legal commentator on that problem. He said that our fear in approaching changes of those dimensions is fear of the unknown. The recent redefinitions of woman's place in our law and our public life, so laboriously obtained, now seem natural and even inevitable. The same institutional changes have altered the setting for relationships between individual men and women. If women today seem more ready to risk offering guidance in terms of the values that they bring to the marketplace and the public life, and if men seem more ready to risk taking that guidance seriously, one reason is that we have begun the reconstruction of the social and legal order that defines woman's place. We have come just far enough to see that this first reconstruction will remain incomplete until we undertake the second and inner one. To dismantle the traditional dual construct of woman and of man will require both a redefinition of individual lives and the redefinition of our legal order. In both those processes of redefinition, men can learn much from women's experience and women's perceptions, and vice versa. The first step is in conquering fear of the unknown, and that first step is, after all, to learn more about it. Thank you. I'm sorry I took so much time, Karen.
I'm going to speak to you on a personal note right now because I had a striking personal experience when I read that response to the bishop's pastoral last February. What happened was that I wrote that in the safety of my own office, and I was fired up with all the things you get fired up when you're a writer and you think you've got the language down and you're really moving and it's great. And I went to the auditorium up at the School of Social Work, and I looked out over the audience. I was sitting up there with the hierarchy of the Catholic Church and of the University of Utah, and I looked and saw in the first two rows the entire hierarchy of state government, all men, and then behind them were numerous people of the cloth, you know, whole roll of bishops' collars, priest collars, and then people I recognized as ministers of various Protestant churches, and people that I knew well to be important people in this community from other institutions and organizations, some of them business organizations, and one or two women. Well, what happened to me is I said, oh, you are in the wrong place with the wrong speech. And I stood up, and I just kind of tried to reconstruct that today because I wanted to see if I'd get scared again. I stood up, and I thought, and I these two people who know me well can tell you I almost never get scared. But I stood up, and I could feel the entire, every gram of blood drained right straight out of my body. It was all I could do. If I hadn't had it typed so that I could read it, I would not have been able to go on. It was absolutely everything I could do to hang on to my knees and my elbows and my voice and get through that. Now, I'll tell you what happened to me. What happened to me was I was looking at my father's in every possible form, all sitting there in the audience, and I had a very uppity speech. And what we daughters learn, above all, is not to incur the disapproval of the fathers. That is not just wisdom, that is survival. Absolutely, utterly, totally survival. I can tell you that feeling of fear did not come from stage fright. It came from, I was going to be struck by lightning. I was violating a principle of the universe. It was from my gut. It was instinctual. I really, really, really thought I had stirred waves that would never, never smooth over. And of course, it was momentary and it passed, and I got control of my knees again and I sat down. But the reason I want to tell you about that is because I'm to talk to you about the social repercussions of paternalism, and there they are. It leaves us without courage, without guts. It leaves our only survival instinct as instincts which cause us to be dependent. Churches are really about empowerment. Religions talk a lot about empowering persons. But notice, they empower men to make decisions, to be decisive, to be responsible, to take care of, and they empower women to serve more, to serve better, to serve longer, to serve more exquisitely. They empower women to go into a kind of suicide of self. Religions are opposed generally to suicide, and I think they should be opposed to this one. They've never seen it that way because the system has always worked before. It no longer works. It is changing. And we don't have any rules. I don't know how to act around my husband. He doesn't know how to act around me. Everything's changing all the time. We have all kinds of bristly, knocked-off places everywhere where we're trying to work that out day by day. I repeat that experience if I work in a corporation. I repeat that experience if I'm committed to a religion and I go to church regularly. I repeat that experience day after day after day. This is a miserable and uncomfortable time for everybody. So if you think you're the only one that's miserable, think again. You just have to look to the person right next door to you, and you will find another miserable person, more or less on any given day. And what we are really talking about is something that Christine, I think, pointed to from a legal point of view, and we are talking about our senses of self. We are talking about our identity. We are not fooling around here with something that doesn't mean anything to us. We are talking about the most important thing in our lives, who we are. And who women think they are causes them to have some very, very, very self-destructive, suicidal, bizarre behaviors. Let me just name a few of them. One, it happened here in Utah in 1972. A bank that I will not mention was found to be out of compliance with equal pay for equal work laws. The women in the bank were all returned back wages. Every woman in the bank, except for two, turned her check into management saying, "I wouldn't want to take money from you. You have been very good to me." Any Mary Kay Cosmetics salesperson will tell you that the best sales go to welfare women, and that they sell better just before the welfare check comes. They will encumber a great portion of their check, which is all they have to live on, to buy cosmetics. That makes perfect sense if you believe your only way to survive is to get a husband, and to get a husband you have to be pretty and you have to get approval. That makes absolute sense. And that is why that woman does that. Nobody has ever told her differently. It's self-destructive, it's suicidal, it's absolutely predictable in our society. The successful woman who is reported in the Tribune or the Desert News who says, "Oh, I'm not a feminist. Absolutely, I am not a feminist. I believe in equal pay for equal work, of course, but I'm not a feminist." You know what that is? That's code for, "Don't make a mistake, men. I'm on your side, not theirs. Don't mistake my loyalties." And that's why they say that. Even though 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, but for feminists, they would not have the jobs they now hold. John C. Bolt at the University of Utah did a study, fascinating study. He sent to regional banks, chose banks because banks were the only place where women were represented in management to enough degree that this would be a valid survey, sent two resumes to certain managers throughout the West. The only thing that was different about these two resumes was that one had the name of a woman at the top and one had the name of a man at the top. Guess what? The men were employed at $10,000 more money. The people were asked, would they employ this person? What would their entry-level job be? What did they see as their future? The men were employed at average $10,000 more money a year. The women were encouraged to go into the bank as tellers, that's why. And the career path for a man was right up into upper management. The career path seen for women was up into some sort of lower loan officer kind of position. No difference between those resumes except that there was a Jane Doe at the top of one and a John Doe at the top of the other. That's how women get where they are. And that's why the women at the bank turned in their check. Because life for women is very fragile these days. You have to be very kind to the fathers or you may be out on the street. And even when you are kind to the fathers, you may be out on the street anyway. And it's very hard to decide where your new loyalties should lie. Paternalism increases our self-doubt. It increases our sense of helplessness. It tells us that if we are helpless, and you've seen women do this 1,000 times, men, and I have done it 1,000 times, and every woman in this room has been exquisitely helpless in order to get saved 100 times in her life. Right? It just happens like breathing for us. Now when you get helpless, you get nabbed. So we have to change. It also increases our feeling, and this happens very often to successful women, that we're frauds. That but for some little bit of luck, we never would have made it. We wouldn't get our paycheck. We wouldn't get our promotion. It's just absolutely an accident that Network has gone on for 7 years and that we now publish 4 other publications. It's an accident that Christine Durham is a justice. It's an accident that Jenna Kelson is the director of the Phoenix Institute. That just sort of happened because we're lucky. And any day now, we're all going to be demoted or fired. Women all carry that feeling around to some degree or another, and the paternalism feeds that every day. Okay, with that, I don't have a smashing close. I'm just going to stop and take your questions, and we'll just kind of pass this microphone around. So, Jenna has a plan. She always has a plan. You want to?
I think we can hear. Why? Repeat the question. The question is, do I see any change in the pink collar ghetto, which is predominantly clerical and secretarial people working in a subordinate role in offices? I don't in Utah. Now, there has been some interesting things that have happened nationally. In Texas, because of the demand for secretaries, which is kind of ironic anyway. It always makes me giggle when I start to talk about it. Because of the shortage of secretaries, they didn't up the salary, but they started offering TV sets for people, women who would come to work in those empty positions, which, you know, and a lot of us, as there has been a move away from secretarial positions by women, into other kinds of jobs, have hoped that there would be a higher level of pay in that occupation. Unfortunately, that's not true. I just got national statistics across my desk. Nationally, there are 1/3 of the women who work are in clerical positions, and their average salary is just a little above $13,000 nationally, which means in Utah it's probably lower than that, undoubtedly. That is awful. And it speaks to the whole comparable worth thing. I don't see them unionizing, certainly not in Utah.
There is a new, I don't know how recent, a union called 925. It's headed by Nancy, Kassebaum. I know that it's very recent, but aren't they beginning to represent not only clerical workers, but also a lot of service occupations, which are primarily women? I don't know how much success they have.
Yes, 9 to 5 is there, and there is another organization that is founded around the 80% of women who work, like I said, in Utah, earning less than $16,000. Nationally, it's a little higher than that. And I think there are some of those organizing efforts. What I'm saying is there has been no measurable impact on wages for clerical workers or secretaries that we have seen. The only group that has spun out of that in any way, shape, or form are legal secretaries who are getting some recognition by higher pay, and they are at the top of the scale. There's also executive secretaries.
Those certified.
The ones that are certified. But quantitatively, it's not changing the money. And we continue to have a large gap. In Utah, women earn 53 cents for every dollar that a man makes.
Yes, but she touched on
expecting that they're going to be dependent and then ask them to do it again. It's going to take, those are the women on welfare. The 20-year-old, the average woman on welfare, 20 years old, 2 children, no job skills, barely made it through high school or maybe didn't make it through high school. She ended up on welfare. We need to tell our children, our daughters. They need to hear it from you. They needed to hear it from their churches and their schools, and they need, their sons need to know all of that. Yes.
I want to say first of all that I'm a feminist.
And I'm going to turn this over to Christine Durham if she'll come out here and talk about it. I'm not LDS, and so I don't feel qualified to answer that. And I submit to you that every church has the same doctrine in one form or another.
Some of us are LDS and don't feel capable of answering that question.
We've all assumed, since we're at the Sunstone Symposium, that when you said the church, you were talking about the LDS church. Will somebody volunteer to finish for me, just in case my memory is faulty, lest I should embarrass myself in public, the article of faith which begins, "We believe that the first principles and ordinances of the gospel are..." Those are the first principles. So far as I know, none have ever been added to them in terms of primacy and firstness. I suggest to you that they are the last principles. And I suggest to you that much of what we accept and incorporate as doctrinal teaching is the reflection of cultural, historic, and personal values and assumptions, customs and mores, and is not doctrinal in its origin. Now, that's a premise. You go out and test it. We haven't got time to argue it out here today. Could I respond to that? And I have five children, no grandchildren yet, thank heavens. My oldest is only 17. We can wait a while. She didn't say, although I think she meant to teach them to be assertive and gutsy, what she said was, we must teach them to be responsible for themselves. And that is the first principle of the gospel the church in this community teaches. It teaches that we are responsible doctrinally for our own salvation. That translates very readily into responsibility for our own well-being. Your comments about your children underscore everything that has been said here today. Half of those children are in the marketplace. In 10 years, it will be more than half if economic conditions do not change. Far better for one of those children to be in a high-paying, high-responsibility, high-autonomy job so that when the babysitter doesn't show up and there's a program at the school and there's a counselor's appointment that has to be met or the dentist will only schedule at 11 a.m., she has the flexibility, the freedom, and is in a position of control to engage in those parenting and family responsibilities and not to suffer from the debilitating and terrible kinds of problems that women in low-paying, low-remuneration, low-power jobs have when they try to juggle those responsibilities with their family responsibilities. That's right. And do you think we're going to raise the salaries for school teachers in this state in the foreseeable future? You know, interestingly enough, one of the reasons that school teachers are paid so little historically is that it is a female-dominated profession. So the husbands, in this case, are suffering from some of the problems that we have described here today. The second problem is that as soon as you start talking about raising the salaries of teachers, you have to go to the taxpayers and ask them to pay taxes to do that. If you come from this community, you have seen spread all over our front pages in the last 2 weeks the response of the elderly and the homeowners to the notion that we would raise property taxes. The point is, for whatever historic reasons, we have some hard facts to live with today, and it's women in the largest numbers who are being hit by those facts. How did I get stuck with that?
We have to fight. Since it was my remark, I get it. I was a homemaker for many years, and I'll tell you something. I think it's the hardest job. I think it's the most wonderful job on earth. There's absolutely no question about it. There is one problem about it, and that is the legal problem that I never asked, and I have asked now, but how many of you who are homemakers have ever turned to your husband and said, "This is a small business we're in together, dear. What is my equity in this small business?" If homemakers would know what their equity was in a marriage, and if they could secure that equity, and therefore be guaranteed that if the marriage dissolves, either by death or divorce or disability, that they would have that equity, then absolutely every woman who can manage on earth should never go out and get a job skill. If they don't know that equity, if they cannot legally secure that equity, then they are walking on quicksand, and only the luck of the draw or whatever kind of good fortune happens to them or bad fortune will guide what happens to them in their lives or what happens to daughters in their lives.
I never do that. I never treat my daughters that way at all. I only had a temper tantrum when my daughter preferred stuffed animals to dolls. I only had another temper tantrum when she chose to work in Salt Lake County Animal Services rather than in schools. You know, it just goes on and on. I think we all are guilty of trying not to do that, and yet we do it in hundreds of unseen ways. And that's part of that socialism, teaching our daughters a different thing than what we were taught, and teaching our sons different than how we saw our brothers taught, is not something that really translates easily into behavior. And I think we all get caught up into it. And I think that is part of the struggle that we're all having. I want my daughters and sons to have children. I love my one grandchild. It's a lot more fun than my own children. And I want a whole bunch more. I'm envious that people that have more grandchildren, you can do a lot more fun things with your grandchildren. And so we pass that on. And it's not that isn't okay in my head. It's that we balance that. And we also teach our sons that their wives need to be economically independent. Right now I'm having a struggle with my son and his wife because he doesn't want to give her a bank account or give her any control of money. This is my son. You know, I raised him to be different than that. And it's they don't have a lot of money to share, you know. And it's real easy for him to write the checks out. And what does that do to Chris? So it's both ways. I think, you know, it is a struggle.
Yeah, I'm fine. Go ahead.
Let's take a man. You're courageous.
I want to, hopefully I can articulate this correctly. In discussing paternalism from a feminine perspective, and I mean that in the female sense, we talk about teaching the daughters, and I want to make sure that I am understood that we're not trying to teach them paternalism. I think, in a sense, we would probably, in the sense of we, and give people in this room, further a cause of equity in all things if there's more of a sense of teaching males maternalism in the pure sense of the word. Because I think, in my own personal experience, men stand to lose a lot more with the status quo. And I think, even though the momentum doesn't seem that way, women will gain what they're going to gain because the law of averages is they're going to get mad enough to gain it. But I think men stand to lose a lot more in an optimistic and a positive sense. They can gain a lot more by working in that direction from the feminine perspective. From what feminists can gain, if they can get men to do that, and I don't mean, of course, give them, because I don't think men have the right to give that, but I just, that's just all I want to
look at. What do you think about that?
I have to follow up what you were saying about men having the power to give that. I caught you saying, you know.
Oh, I never do that.
We sure do.
We're
caught. All born in the same way, in the same culture, basically.
You know, it's her responsibility, obviously, to take the good arrow pointed.
Right, and she's a powerful young woman, and yet that still occurs. And you notice I hardly blushed at all when you said that, because you caught me. Fifty 50% of marriages with children will end in divorce in less than 7 years. I see cracks in the LDS church. I see some cracks. And I don't mean that in a destructive sense. I see some growing interest in the situation for single parents. And within the Relief Society hierarchy itself, some strong interest in child care. I think that the economic realities are there for the, I know they're there for the church as well as for, it's not just a Gentile situation, it is everywhere. And there has to be some accommodation to the realities of that because there are the single women that are needing that kind of assistance. Do you want to try?
Well, I'd like to reinforce what you say. And I, being LDS, I'm more familiar, I think, with internal changes that are occurring at the grassroots level there. And I see ward and stake employment specialization officers who circulate in Relief Society once a month or once a quarter lists for people who are in need of employment. I see half of the women in my ward who work for a living, just like, I guess the reason we've tended to de-emphasize the LDS church in our remarks here today is that there is really not very much that is doctrinally or pragmatically speaking different about that as an institution than about other forms of organized religion and other churches. Now, there are exceptions, and I know now there are female rabbis in some congregations of Reformed Judaism, but there aren't very many. And there are no female priests, and there are certainly, and we will wait long before we see women officiating in the rites or governments of Muslim religions. We are not as different and unique, other than as we are smaller, and those of us who are near to the center are much more affected by, because it is so much closer and so much more a part of our lives than perhaps other members of other institutional churches may be. But I too see, well, the economic realities, as Jenna says, have come home. The facts and the figures that face the leaders of my church, as well as the leaders of all of the churches, the bishops who were concerned about the pastoral letter. Karen's focus and emphasis was not in the pastoral letter. That's why she gave her speech. The awareness is growing. The needs of the membership are growing. And like most institutions, churches respond very slowly to those kinds of needs. But I see responsiveness coming.
Let's take one more over here. It's nearly 5:30, and he's been frustrated with it. Wonderful. Encourage you.
Thank you all very, very much.